Schoolboy rugby has perhaps not been the best thing for the development of our players in our game, I reckon. I've got this little framework that I've stolen basically from Razor Robertson around early in his days around building culture. He talked around some elements of that, and the first one being belonging. So we've got to create a sense of belonging. So the Owen Eastwood stuff, and the second one is around belief. So we have to actually believe in ourselves and each other, and the third one is behavior. Like, I should know better, but yeah, there's a bit of a fuck up, to be honest with you, but we live and we learn. And but you can measure
Yeah.
success in different ways, but you have to have some success. Like, you can't, like, what comes first, the winning or the cult, or the culture? Like, they feed into each other, and I think that's why it takes time.
Hey, I hope you're keeping well. I'm Brian Moylett, former rugby player, now mindset and performance coach. And welcome to the pod. This podcast is about well-being and high performance. And in it, you will learn how you can be happier, more fulfilled, and more successful. I recently wrote the book on how I become a pro rugby player, Forward by Robbie Henshaw, which went to number one in the charts, and you can get this now on Amazon and Audible, with the links in the show notes. Please connect with me now over on social media at Brian Moylett and at Offfield Rugby. If you enjoyed the pod, please subscribe to it, leave a rating and a review wherever you're listening now. And also, you can send it on to some friends. Would really appreciate that. All right, we'll get into today's episode. Cheers. Hey, hope you're keeping well. Today, I'm chatting to Mike Rogers, Manawatu head coach in the NPC, who's also spent some time in Major League Rugby with New England Free Jacks and throughout many other different kind of teams and levels in New Zealand rugby. Brilliant to have you on, Mike.
Hi, mate. Thanks very much for, I guess, reaching out and asking me to come on. First thing I want to say is I really appreciate people like yourself who do this great work. And as we were just talking about, hopefully we can keep the conversation pretty authentic and give some I don't know, some sort of insight in terms of, what I've been up to and also the world of rugby, which I think is really cool. So thank you.
Cheers. So, yeah, what are you up to this time of the year? Kind of like an off season for you at the moment, is it?
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit of a change for me. So, as you said, I've been over with the New England Free Jacks and MLR in 2022 and 23. So, this would be, season starting there and would be full noise. So I haven't gone back this year to focus on the Manawatu NPC stuff. So we're in off-season phase at the moment, and our massive focus is around building our academy program and doing a really good job in that space. So the union's invested heavily in terms of resource and recruiting and retaining our best local talent. So mate, it's a bit of a big job to, I guess, start something. It's actually really cool starting something more or less from scratch in terms of what do we think best practice could look like, how can we accelerate the learning and growth of our players, and yeah, we're having some trials and tribulations with that, but it's a really invigorating process to go through. So mate, loving it.
Cool. And so, what does that entail? Is it like a kind of standard traditional academy with like age 18 to 22, and you get guys, you're kind of recruiting guys who are in school or just left school and kind of building a program?
Yeah, so it's encompasses two parts. So first thing is our academy is really just for 2 years. So we're so the eight players age under 19 and under 20, and this year's cohort, so the under 19 or year one group this year is really strong. So we've got half a dozen kind of elite level players that have represented New Zealand at age grade level. So that's really awesome, and the majority of those boys are local from Manawatu, a couple of boys from outside of the region as well. So that was a bit of a heap of work went into retaining and securing those players. So probably, I'm not sure whether your listeners know, but Manawatu hasn't been the most successful team in the NPC over the last 10 years by any stretch of the imagination. I took the team over last year. They lost 14 games in a row, so basically 1.5 seasons, and really struggled, with the exception of a good year, I think, in 2014. Had struggled after the Dave Rennie era kind of ended, which I think was 2011. So there's been it's kind of been an up and down period over that time, with the union really getting a handle on who they are, what they're wanting to achieve, and being realistic around immediate success. So I think, everybody wants to win, and sometimes you can get caught up in, I guess, the strive for immediate success versus what's sustainable and what's really good for your team and your union in the long term. So, I mean, we've put forward a really compelling proposal around, we want to build out an academy program. We want to start a pathways program, which we've now started. We want to invest heavily in coach development in terms of our best coaches in the region coaching our best players. And all that work's underway, which is really cool. We've kind of flipped it on its head around, what does education look like in an academy program? What does strength and conditioning look like? So setting our sights around being Super Rugby ready, not just being NPC ready, which is a big shift. We're doing some cool stuff. Like Monday night, we ran a workshop on interpreting data and analytics and video, because what we kind of found was players graduating from our academy and coming into our NPC team last year, they didn't know how to interpret GPS data. We measure other stuff around habit efforts. They didn't really know what they're looking for when they're clipping or looking at video. So, to run a workshop on that was actually awesome, and to really, I guess, narrow things down to, hey, the reason why we measure stuff is because we want to drive effort or increase understanding. So, I think that really hit the mark with the players. So, mate, there's lots of work underway. Certainly not a finished product, but it's cool to be able to kind of look at things differently and give a few things a crack. So I think it's probably one thing that Manawatu needs to be is we need to be innovative, and we need to be brave enough to do things differently and maybe break the mold, which is I find that stuff really motivating.
Yeah, cool. And with the academy, how many boys are in there, and what's the schedule like? Like, how often do you have them?
Really good question. So we have 17 players in the group at the moment, which is 11 year ones and 6 year twos. We've just launched a girls academy this year as well, or women's academy, which we've got 7 girls in that program, and that's increasing. And it's all integrated with our high performance program. So they're in the gym 3 or 4 mornings a week. And then they're either in Monday night for education or Wednesday night for field. So because the players all play local club rugby and train on a Tuesday, Thursday, we kind of looked at it and thought that being in Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights was a bit much for them. So we're alternating between education and rugby, I guess. And from that, we've been able to really drive some intensity. So our field session last Wednesday night was awesome because the boys or the group hadn't been together for a couple of weeks. So we've got a series of games that take place over the year. So we've had 3 games in February, and then we play a game in April, May and June in the lead up to NPC. So there's always something on the horizon as well, which I think is important. It's pretty full on. Like, they're all required to be in full-time work or study. So they're in the gym at 5:30 in the morning, shower up, off to work or off to university, and then most evenings they're busy as well. So obviously in an ideal world you'd have full-time professional athletes, but that's not our reality. And what we're trying to do is, I guess, make best use of the time that we have, so they're not coming at the end of an academy system over rugby and not really feeling like they've got too much out of it. So again, I think we have to be pretty creative around that.
Yeah, that's a big challenge rugby-wide, I think, possibly going a bit worldwide with players being over rugby at their late teenage years, isn't it?
Well, mate, I think rugby's lost its soul. And this only really dawned on me last year. I took a group, fortunate enough to have a relationship with the Cobra Rugby Club in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, and they got me to come over and bring a team for their tennis tournament that they have in November, which is awesome. It's the third time that I've been there, and so I took a group of 14 rugby players, most of which are from Manawatu. And for most of those boys, it was the first time they'd ever been on a tour. And these are experienced NPC players. And that really, I guess, it kind of shocked me a little bit because, you know, when I was growing up playing rugby, I was never really good, but I certainly looked forward to opportunities. Like, I still remember fondly first 15 tour to Australia in 1995, other trips and tournaments that I've been to as a like senior rugby player, and a couple of overseas experiences as well. Anyway, I think we've lost that because we're treating everybody as if they're full-time professional, even though they're not. And, you know, as an example, in NPC last year, we played on a Saturday, Wednesday, we played played on Saturday against Canterbury, got pumped, against Northland, and then Wednesday we played Auckland. We flew to Auckland Wednesday morning, played the game, managed to win, which was awesome. But we flew back the next morning. So there wasn't even a time to catch your breath and reflect on the fact that we just beat in Auckland at Eden Park. And then Saturday we're flying to Nelson to play against Tasman on Sunday. You know, and because of that, it's just really become transactional. And so then I think about academy programs, and ultimately they're designed for development. But we've also got to ensure that people love the game. And just making everything transactional and measured and never really building relationships. Like, my connection to a few of the boys that went to Malaysia is far stronger than what I'd get out of coaching them in a whole NPC campaign, because we had time. Like, we trained twice, we played a tournament, we were there for 6 days, we did heaps of touristy type stuff together, shared Ubers to go to the markets, had caught up for breakfast every morning, and everybody kind of had a few stories to tell around what had taken place the night before. But all of that was organic. It wasn't forced. And I have no doubt that those guys are going to be not necessarily easier, but I think I'll probably get a little bit more out of them as a coach. So it's part of what we're trying to do is I'm looking at this going, how can we design our academy program to enable us to tour somewhere? Because I think there's some real gold in there that's currently missing. Because like you said, I think one thing academy programs are great at world over is getting players to be burnt out and sick of rugby. And no doubt, you know, Ireland's a leader in the world at the moment in terms of rugby. But I think for every player that goes on to play for Ireland, there's probably five others that quit rugby when they're 22 or just went back and played for their junior club because they're bloody sick of it. So I don't know, that's how I feel about it anyway. And I'm pretty keen to, you know, get people together and actually enjoy the game.
Yeah, 100%. It is, and you see, it's first 15 or SCT, what we call it in Ireland, schools rugby. And yeah, I think, I don't know, it's become, I suppose the professional game has probably, I don't know, hijacked it a bit in that it's become professional, schools rugby, and yeah, players even at that level below are kind of like, oh, if they don't make an academy, then it's like, what's the point in playing? Some people believe.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of parts to that. So I think schools, you know, it's really similar in New Zealand. There's about 20 elite schools, and they've got those players basically as full-time professionals. So they are studying, but they get them before and after school every day. I think with that, you know, then you've got full-time coaches and all this stuff. And I think with that creates an obligation that we need to deliver a program that's of a professional level. But nobody's stopping and saying and challenging that to say, hey, what's actually required for the best development of these people at this given time? And professionalism and being, you know, training 8 times a week probably isn't that. And then the second component of it is that the way that teams play is often a carbon copy of, you know, the professional team in their region. Or, but again, I really question whether that's the best thing for those players as part of their development journey. So certainly a challenge for us It is a challenge for us. We've got two really strong schools in Manawatu, two Fielding and Palmerston North Boys, and then another school who's strong as well, Manukura. Certainly a challenge for us because those three schools have different styles of play. But a lot of it is, how do I want to say this? It is structured, and players have learned how to play a structure, but they don't really understand why. And the key element that we're trying to coach is the decision-making components within the structure, and often that's been missed. And I understand why, because you know, when I first started coaching club rugby, that's all I did was coach systems, and that was really easy. I found a lot of comfort in that. Pretty easy to get people to, as long as you've got a good enough environment, they'll buy into the system. So, I think there's lots of challenges with this whole professionalism of the game. And, some of it's great in that you get athletes come out of schools who know how to train, and athletically they're really well developed for their age. Some of it's not so great in terms of their decision-making capabilities, poor. They've had no real life experiences because they've been in a bubble and lots of other stuff. And I'm certainly not being critical of the schools in our region, because I do think they do a good job. But I think by and large, school board rugby has perhaps not been the best thing for the development of our players in our game, I reckon.
Yeah, 100%. It's so true what you say about players. I think it's over the last 10 years, maybe 12 years, players have become conditioned to play a structure. And I was very fortunate when I was 16, 18, 20, playing under Nigel Carlin in Connacht. I've mentioned before, but he taught us how to attack space, and he taught us how to create 3v2s, 2v1s, bounce blind, go open, whatever. Like, I remember once, I've mentioned this once or twice here before, but I was playing number 8 and we had a scrum on our own 5 and or maybe 10 out or something close to our line, and I was like, oh, so I'll pick and go here, set up a ruck, and then we kick it. And then he was like, they've 3 back, Brian. And I was like, oh yeah, and looking around, and he was like, no, we attack left because they've only 3 up and we've 7 backs. And you know, and then the players, we had some guys went on to play international in the back line, Kieran Marmion, Jack Carty, Robbie Henshaw, and then they were like, all of our eyes lit up because it was like, oh, we can attack from here, oh wow. And it was like, wow, this is going to be exciting. And it was. And I now coaching players here, look, in Christchurch, and I wanted to be on those principles, attack space, create space, the kind of the basics essentially. And, you know, I was doing it for 2-3 weeks, just doing that kind of stuff. And of course, a shape off 9, shape off 10. But then one or two guys then was like, so 1-3-3-1 or 1-3-3-1-3-2-2, what's the structure? And then like a couple of them were like, oh, geez, you know. And then I was like, kind of, you know, but it takes it. And even we'd be doing a game, and we'll have a ruck somewhere, and there'll be one or two on the blind side with 5, but they'll look to set up a shape and then play that. And it's like, one of them said it too. It's like, we have to unlearn, or, yeah, like kind of decondition.
Mate, you're absolutely right. And I can think back to coaching club rugby, 2015, coaching Tauranga Sports, we played a 2-4-2, and we were the only, at that time, we were the only club team in our region that was playing shape. And we had a really good season and managed to win a championship, which was cool. But it was a competitive advantage because we could retain ball for long periods of time. We could play the full width of the field, and other teams struggled with it. I thought it would take 2 or 3 years for that to get through all clubs. The following year, every single team played a 2-4-2. And all of a sudden, the competitive advantage was gone because we knew how to defend it because we'd been playing it for a year. Other teams started learning how to defend it because they were defending it at training. And it just became a stalemate. And teams understood the deficiencies of it around where you can catch teams on various parts of the field, and they'd struggle to be able to play from there and probably kick you the ball. And so within a year, what had been a real point of difference and a competitive advantage had become neutral. Yet we're now almost 10 years on from that, with teams playing various adaptations of the same thing. And I don't see too many teams getting an advantage from it. Like, it's just kind of what you do. And like you say, we have to get players to unlearn it. And I'm a massive believer in principles-based coaching rather than systems. And like you just said, play the ball into space can be a principle, you know. And I think what we've done is we've all had principles around how we want to play the game, especially from an attacking perspective. We've then looked at that, we've overlaid some sort of system or shape, thinking that that was going to be the thing that would coach our principles for us. But in actual fact, as we've gone on down this path, we're further away from what we set out to achieve in the beginning. And if you look at it at the moment in terms of even the World Cup last year, 90% of breakdowns were one pass off nine, something ridiculous like that. And how does that make any sense? Like, how can that be 90% of the time? How can that be the best possible option that's available to us? Like, there has to be some space somewhere. I agree with you. I think there's a challenge around trying to get players to unlearn this stuff and really go back to some principles rather than the system. And like, systems are ultimately designed to make decision making easier, to align with your principles, but at the moment that seems like they're at opposite ends of a continuum. So I don't know, just my thoughts anyway.
Hey, Brian here. I work one-on-one with rugby players, helping them perform better on the field, enjoy it more, and maximize their careers. If you feel like there's more in you and don't want to have regrets down the line, head over to offfieldrugby.com now and book a free 30-minute Zoom consultation. And the link is in the show notes. On the call, you talk to me about where you're at now, what you would like to achieve, and I'll show you how I can help you get there. You then go off and decide if you want to invest in yourself and move forward with the one-on-one coaching. For teams, I do mental skills sessions over Zoom. Players will have mindset shifts on the call, but also they'll get exercises to practice going forward. So it's like an S&C program, but for your mental strength. If you're a coach or manager of a team, you can book a free 30-minute Zoom consultation now as well on offfieldrugby.com. If you have any other questions, you can get in touch with me through my social media, at Brian Moylett, at Offfield Rugby, or the website, offfieldrugby.com. All right. Cheers. We'll get back into today's episode.
Yeah, no, for sure. I kind of last thing on it before we move on. But players, I think then they become able to tip it or pull it or carry. Like, they, you know, that's all they can do. And because that's just what's been conditioned into them. Whereas, you know, playing rugby, it's really interesting. They become able to just do what their role, the kind of three options they'll have in, whether if they're 10 out the bat, you know, they'll just the three options. Whereas, yeah, there's a million options on the field, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, like it's, we've actually been playing around with some stuff just over the last few weeks around not playing off nine and getting players to understand there's like ruck locations have a higher or a lesser value. And so what I mean by that is midfield breakdowns have a higher value than a wide breakdown. You have two-sided attack and you split the defence. If you can get it real close to the middle of the field, they probably only have six defenders on either side. Nines can run more, so they can't. It's really difficult for a nine to run off a wide breakdown. So straight away, you're not really engaging those first couple of defenders. So I think, and then having a couple of options in terms of maybe how we want to attack that space has value, you know. So I don't want to use the word shape, but a couple of setups that we might use, but they're all fluid and they sit within some principles around we don't want back standing on the edge. Like if we've got a midfield breakdown, like why would we have our best attacking players in the place where you're less likely to get the ball? Doesn't make any sense. So maybe some of our forwards could be standing out a little bit wider, and some of our fast, agile guys might be closer to the ball. And you know, nines being able to engage defenders is a critical principle, because then we can guess the first couple of defenders, and then having basically having options off our first receiver, you know. So even though that sounds really simple, it's really effective, because then ultimately what we're saying is we need to have a couple of these things in play, and that's kind of your shape, if you like, but it doesn't have to look the same every time, and nor do we want it to. And then the defense is going to present you a picture, and you've got to have the courage to have a crack at it. And so that might be they're closing early, so crossfield kick is on, or a kick pass. And this is really funny, and it's going to make me sound like I'm a little bit slow. But I was talking to our attack coach the other day, Robbie Robinson, and he was talking about this concept of if their winger or midfielder closes early and cuts off the space for us to be able to get it, you know, into the wider channel. You know, this, you know, we don't want players throwing bridge passes because it gives teams recovery time. And I'm like, yeah, that makes sense to me. He's like, so I want them to kick it. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool, like crossfield kick type stuff or kick pass. He's like, yeah, but you got to remember that we can only ever pass the ball backwards, but we can kick it forwards. And that was kind of a massive light bulb moment for me to go, shit, if we can execute this kick option and it's forward, not sideways or backwards, they've got no recovery time. And it's obviously because I was a front row when I played the game that I'd never really considered this. But and then we had the boys exploring some of it at training last Wednesday night. And it's impossible for them to recover if you can execute the kick, because we're running onto it. They're already closed. They've passed the ball. They've got to turn and chase. It is a difficult skill, but it's only a difficult skill because we haven't practiced it. So that sort of stuff's really exciting. Eh? You know, imagine that every time they close, we kick. What's it going to force them to do? Well, they can't close anymore, so it's going to mean they're probably sitting on us, so we can go at them. So all of a sudden, we start dictating what the defense is doing rather than the other way around. So for me, that sounds a lot more exciting playing like that than setting up a pot of three forwards off nine and getting wasted nine times out of ten.
Yeah, 100%. That's class. And you do see a couple of teams sometimes, not very often, doing that. Like Finn Russell, put, I think Scotland have do it a bit in the past, last couple of years, and they're lethal. Like that little kick pass, 20, 30 metres. And like I said, I don't think it's... sure, I remember growing up, it's like you weren't allowed kick because it was too risky. You know, and it's because, well, don't practice it, or I don't know, it's just, it's mad. But yeah, if you practice that a lot and you have players who can do that kick, then it's borderline impossible to defend.
Yeah, I think we need to be encouraging our players to explore all sorts of kick options. Like we've got a midfielder, Kyle Brown's his name, he's left footed. He can kick, and he's actually got that skill set, but he chooses not to use it. You know, so little secret mission that I set him before training last Wednesday night is I want to see you putting the ball in behind, especially if they're coming up hard. And so we're doing a 15-on-15 activity in the first 3-minute block. He put a kick in behind, the fullback managed to get to the ball, and I could just see that he was deflated straight away. Like he was like, oh, it's a failure. So I connected with him in the little break between the 3-minute blocks, and I was like, mate, that's awesome. He's like, what do you mean? I went straight to the fullback. I said, yeah, but a meter either side of him, and we're putting them under a huge amount of pressure. We might not get the ball back, but we'll put them under a huge amount of pressure. So, you know, you only miss by a meter. You know, if you think about that in golf terms, if you miss a shot by a meter, you're probably not too concerned about it. So I was like, mate, that's not far off. And then he kicked again in maybe the third block, and we put them under a bit of pressure. And then the last block he kicked, and we scored a try from it. And so I was like, mate, when we got to the end of it, I was like, well, we had three kicks. One was not accurate. Meant that they got the ball and were able to get out of jail free, basically. The second one, we put them under pressure. And the third one, we scored a try. I'd be happy with those odds all day. Like, absolutely. You know, that's really good reward for you actually having the courage to have a go at the skill, you know. So if, I think that's something that I learned off Rusty Earnshaw is around these secret missions and setting players little goals within sessions. So I guess there's a game within a game happening the whole time, and I think that's, you know, there's some real goal to be had there, and we can't just expect to take kicking practice in a static environment, kicking the ball to one another, and then put it into a game context and expect people to just do it in the actual game. We need to encourage them to do it at training and you know, pick them up if it didn't go so well. Like, it's not the end of the world.
100%. Yeah, 100%. And switching up a bit, how did you end up going to Boston with the Free Jacks in Major League Rugby? How did that come about, and how did you find it?
So my coaching journey, just it'll put this into context, as I coach, as I said before, I coached local club team that I played for from 2010 to 2015. Learned lots, made lots of mistakes, have lots of regrets. Then coached the Bay of Plenty under 19 team, which is effectively academy, from 2015 to 2018. Off the back of that, managed to get an opportunity to coach with Bay of Plenty in the NPC 2019 and 2020 under Clayton McMillan, the now Chiefs head coach, which is awesome to be able to work under a head coach like him in my first couple of years at that level. Then the union had, Clayton left to go to the Chiefs, union had a change of direction, so I was basically without a job. Went and coached women's rugby with the Waikato FPC team in 2021. And during that, during that time, I was basically looking at wherever I could get another opportunity to coach professionally. And the head coach role with the Free Jacks came up, which I applied for and interviewed and missed out to Scott Methy, which was all good. And you know, Scott just rang me up randomly one day. Never met the guy before in my life, never spoken to him. Knew that he'd been given the job, and we spoke on the phone for about an hour. And by the end of that conversation, he offered me the assistant coach role there. And Scott and I are now really good mates, connect with them all the time, actually really missing them at the moment. It's hard watching the team and not be there to kind of experience that with him. And spent 2 years at the Free Jacks, and as an incredible experience to coach with a South African head coach. So really different mentality around some elements of the game, some real consistent things in terms of how I feel about defence, which is what I coached there. And how he felt about that, and how we used it in terms of our transition attack. I had an awesome time over there. Boston's a fantastic city. There's so many highlights, but I guess the one that kind of sits with me the most is we played our first home game in snow in 2022, and I think the crowd was about 1,200 or 1,500 people. And then that was a bit of a buzz for the club at the time, because that was, I think, the best crowd that they'd had. They're only really in their third year. And, you know, that was cool. Like, it was actually a bit of a vibe around the place with that many people. And then by the end of year two, we played Houston. We had 4,800 people, or 4,700 people. And to see that growth in terms of the, you know, the fan base and engagement from the local community, and the team becoming known around town, was absolutely mind-blowing. You know, like, in a city that's renowned for professional sport, to actually start getting articles in the Boston Globe, to start getting coverage on TV, to having almost 5,000 people turn up to a game, is amazing, eh? And real credit to the organisation, and I guess also credit to the rugby department as well, because we're having some success. So, I'm certainly missing it. I'm actually going over for a visit at the end of next month. So looking forward to getting over there and seeing how things are going. And, mate, there's a lot like we talked about before we jumped on, some stuff around being able to build a culture from scratch is a unique proposition, and one that I'm really grateful for, because you don't often get that. As a coach, you always inherit a culture to a certain degree, right? So Scott and I basically had an opportunity to build something from nothing around our identity, and mate, we had lots of fun with that stuff, and we had some success as well, which I think, you know, demonstrates that I think we got lots of those things right.
Cool. And what kind of things definitely cool getting to build a culture and start from scratch. What kind of things did you do?
I've got this little framework that I've stolen basically from Razor Robertson around early in his days around building culture. He talked around some elements of that, and the first one being belonging. You know, so we've got to create a sense of belonging. So the Owen Eastwood stuff. And the second one is around belief. You know, so we have to actually believe in ourselves and each other. And the third one is behavior. And so, you know, I remember talking to Scott about this around going into the 2022 year, like what our focus was going to be. And our focus, we decided, or what we wanted to really hang our hats on, was the belonging component. So we designed a theme. I'm really big on theming, and it was Money Heist. And it was random because I was just watching the Netflix series and I became pretty obsessed with it. And I was watching it with Nikki, my partner, and I had been rattling around in my mind for ages. I had all these different theming ideas, and it just kind of hit me one night around how we could use the Money Heist theme to create a sense of belonging. And it was around the names, you know, so the Money Heist characters are named after their home city. So you've got Denver and Tokyo and all these things. So we hatched a bit of a plan around that being a really good starting point, because we really needed to get to know each other. And what I have found especially in MLR, like you've got players from all around the world. I think we had 11 nations or something. And so really pushing that to the forefront around becoming the place where you're from. You know, so mine's Tongariro, which is a mountain in the middle of the central North Island, which is our maunga, or our mountain for our iwi, our tribe. And so just being able to have that conversation with players around, hey, what is this thing? That's a mountain. Well, how can you be from a mountain? And being able to explain the significance of that, I think was a really good starting point around that belonging piece. So when we launched our theme, it was pretty cool. We did an amazing race around Boston. Scott and I were actually stationed at the Cheers Bar in central Boston. Players had to come there and do a challenge, so we were just drinking beer most of the day, which was quite enjoyable. Good way to get to know each other. And we finished up at a hotel for like a meet and greet sort of thing. And anyway, the lights go out. We've left about 5 minutes before that. Players haven't noticed we're leaving. We're dressed in Money Heist boiler suits with masks on. We come in the lights. It's pitch black in the room, and we cable tied everybody up. And basically, like, we're kidnapping them, and lights come on, and then we just did a bit of, like, we had them, like, seated in groups all, man, it was hilarious. Like, Scott somehow took on a Scottish accent when he was in there in the heist, and we launched the theme around that in terms of, you know, we're going to treat the year as a heist, which was around the belonging piece, and then, you know, language that we could use. You know, away games were always a heist, so it's get in, get out, go get some points, get back home. And we renamed our training facility to the Mint. We had a vault that we managed to find in the base. Where the crazy thing is, the building that we were in was the Bank of America building. So straight away there was a connection with that. We found a vault, an old safe in the bottom in the basement, that became our weekly KPI target. So if the players achieved an objective, might be score a maul try or stop their maul or score a try from a special or score a transition try or whatever. And it was always something we could kind of hang our hat on, that if we nailed this objective, we'd win the game. They got to open the vault on the Monday morning in the review meeting, and there was always a prize in there. So that ranged from Patrick Chung was also managed to get all the players a pair of Bose headphones. We had tickets to Celtics games. It's pretty cool when you've got owners that value culture stuff. So, yeah, mate, there's lots of stuff that we did within that, all around trying to grow that belonging piece. And then for year two, the focus shifted to belief. And so the theme was Road to Fenway. So Fenway Park's where the Red Sox play. And our objective for the year was to play the final of the MLR on Fenway Park. Never been done before. Was highly unlikely that it could happen given the clash of the seasons, but just gave us something to really hang our hat on, that we wanted to build such an audience that veterans were sold out. We could no longer play there. we had to move to a bigger stadium was the thing. But around that came heaps of, we're really driving the belief part is because Boston's win or bust. So you know, you would have seen the Celtics last year, the last 2 years made the NBA final and the conference final, lost both. Two or three days after they've lost the games, they're no longer in the media. Everybody's turned against them. It's not acceptable not to win, right? And that's the Boston sports culture. So we were like, man, we just need to embrace this. This is we're based in the city. This is what it's all about. And we need to believe that we're actually good enough to win. And yeah, we did heaps of cool stuff along the way around our theming in terms of that. But it was really driving that belief component. And the last part is really around behavior, which we've just built on as we've gone. So the first one around that is we want to be the hardest working team in the competition. And my second year there, we employed a S&C coach by the name of George Petrakos, who's an absolute guru, totally transformed our ability to live in games for long periods. So, you know, really excel in long ball and play moments, changed the way that we trained to be consistent with it. And over time, you just get real buy-in that, hey, this is who we are. So when training is difficult, nobody's complaining because they know that, man, if we get a 90-second ball and play period in a game, we're probably going to score a try or create an opportunity. So, yeah, like, mate, when you've got a clean slate, you can go about doing these things in a creative way. I love the culture stuff, and I was really fortunate to work with Scott, who gave me a little bit of creative license, I guess. Like, he thought I was crazy when I was telling him that we were going to do this heist as our theme launch and tie everybody up, and but certainly had some impact, and yeah, it's good fun.
That's class. It's probably a bit scary as well, is it, when you're kind of thinking of these themes and how elaborate, and potentially if some, I don't know, if it doesn't work, or if some people don't buy in, or if you don't get it right, do you feel that, any kind of worry around that?
Oh, there's always anxiety around it. It was funny where I had a beer with a couple of the Free Jacks players who were in New Zealand in October, November. And we just went along to this local bar here and we're having a couple of craft beers. And one of the players' name's Cam Davidovitz. And you know, Cam's a farmer from Massachusetts and he's really honest. And he just told me straight out that he thought it was a shit theme because he said, at the end of the day, there was no way we're ever going to get to play on Fenway Park. And I said, yeah, I knew that. It doesn't mean that it wasn't something to aspire to. And I'm like, but we did get to Fenway. And he's like, what do you mean? And I said, well, Kyle Sakira, the Eagle, threw the first pitch in one of the opening games of the Red Sox season this year. And, mate, that's epic. Like, if I'd said that to you at the beginning of the year that was going to happen, you'd have told me there's no way in hell in the next 10 years that anyone from the Free Jacks would be throwing the first pitch at a Red Sox home game. And so he could kind of see where I was coming from and could see that the concept of the theme is not necessarily the outcome, but the, you know, all the stuff that goes around it. But to answer your question, yeah, there is a lot of anxiety in there. Like, we used the theme, David and Goliath theme, for Manawatu last year. Really fitting because, you know, Manawatu had periods of, you know, long periods of not having a lot of success. And the first part of the season was really good for us. We competed with Wellington. We're ahead after 67 minutes. We competed with Taranaki, lost by a try to them. We got wasted by Canterbury. But, you know, that's three of the top four teams that we played first up, and we had, like, lots of periods in those games. We were doing well. We then beat Northland last play of the game, and we beat Auckland last play of the game. And the Auckland win was the first time in 40 years that Manawatu had won at Eden Park. And so the whole thing around David and Goliath was wanting to be giant killers. And there was a newspaper article the following day, and they had no idea what our theme was, calling us the giant killers of the NPC. And so I've got that newspaper article, which is really cool. But like all themes, what I found really challenging in NPC, because it's 10 games in 9 weeks, is to keep it alive. And there's so many things that we needed to improve on from a rugby perspective that I overlooked the culture element. And by the end of the season, we had a really negative culture. You know, so we ended up losing 5 games on the bounce and played really poorly towards the end of the season. And if I reflect on that, I think a massive contributing factor to that was that we didn't continue building on the culture. You know, we were busy, you know, you're struggling for form, struggling for confidence. And as probably most rugby coaches would do, we focus on the rugby rather than the people. And mate, that's not the answer. Like I should know better, but yeah, there's a bit of a fuck up, to be honest with you, but we live and we learn.
That's something I'm kind of doing at the moment, yeah, is building the culture. And it's challenging in that I was chatting to last year Brent Frew, who was Burnside Director of Rugby Adam on here, coach of Crusaders for a few years, skills coach, and he said that he showed me a 3-year plan, and I was kind of just chatting to him around. I was like, oh yeah, I like this. This looks good. Why this? Da-da-da. We're just chatting. And I kind of said to him, why 3 years? You know, why not 2, 4, 1? Why do you put a 3-year plan together? And he said that turning around it or with a team, with a club, it's like a big tanker. So you can't turn a tanker really quickly. You know, it's slowly but surely, and little things, small things. And I liked that analogy, and I've just held it with me a bit this season. I'm a head coach at Div 1 here in Christchurch, and you know, some things go really well, and you know, you're implementing things, you're chatting about these kind of things around culture, how we want to be and who we want to be and all that, and then you know, something bad happens or something, you see something, you're like, oh. And kind of the first thing for me is like, oh geez, it's, I don't know, I thought it'd be all sorted in a week or two, you know, a couple of classroom sessions, it'd all be sorted. But I don't know, it's something that I have to remind myself that it can take time.
Yeah, it takes time, and irrespective of what people say, you have to have success. And but you can measure success in different ways, but you have to have some success. Like, you can't, like, what comes first, the winning or the culture? Like, they feed into each other, and I think that's why it takes time. But we had a little bit of a dream run at the Free Jacks where I think in season one we won 13 out of 16 games, and season two we won 14 out of 16, and then managed to win the title. Like, but because of that, we had really good buy-in, and there was not a lot of resistance to change because it was new. Like, there wasn't, oh, we've done that before, or players that 10-year veterans who are just old and grizzly who just want to train very little and play every week. Like, there wasn't that mentality, you know. So, and then you look at established teams, mate, it certainly takes time. I think it takes years, to be honest with you. Like, if you look at the Crusaders as an example, like, their culture's been built on 20 years of success. And so, or more than that. And, you know, they probably don't, even though they're not having a great period at the moment, they're probably not deviating away too far from what's worked before. So, and then they have absolute belief that that's actually who they are and what they're about. So, yeah, it takes time. And I've certainly seen that with Manawatu, that that's going to take time. And that part of the reason why we've invested so heavily in the academy program is, you know, we want those guys being the, you know, when they make the NPC team, they're ready to go in terms of what the expectations are and how to operate and how we conduct ourselves and how we treat each other and how much love and care and stuff like that's in the environment. They won't be new to them. They should be capable of stepping in on day one and actually being able to lead some of that stuff. So, we have to start at that level, and it's going to take some time, but I think that's a cool challenge as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And love and care you mentioned there, that can be alien to some people, can't it, in rugby circles, or using words like that?
Oh, mate, I think it's funny. I was talking to, so we've got a new addition in our family. Little Layla Jane was born 7 weeks ago. And
congrats.
Thank you. And so, you know, that, just thinking about love, like, that's one of those things that just kind of happens immediately. Eh? And anyway, my story is we were at the hospital and I was talking to the midwife. And, you know, she was just chatting to me about rugby environments and, you know, you know, it must be really macho and everybody's trying to be a tough guy and all this sort of thing. And I'm like, to be honest, like maybe 20 years ago, you know, 10 years ago in some places, I'm like, you'd be blown away by how much care there is for each other in our environment. And yet players are competing because everybody wants to play, but they're also looking after each other. And I think what's happened, which has enabled a lot of this, is it's really brutal to be a professional rugby player. Like it's a tough job. Like everything's measured. Like you can't go for a shit without somebody knowing. You know, if this the feedback loop's constant, there wouldn't be another job other than professional sport where, you know, everything is available. Every little piece of information is available to everybody, and you're under the microscope the whole time. And I think with that comes a lot of mental health challenges. And so players are now understanding that because they've either been through things or they've seen their friends go through similar stuff. They're developing a lot more empathy skills, and coaches are, I think good coaches are leading that stuff, and maybe coaches who it is a little bit foreign to talk about love and care are actually starting to see that role model by their players now. So it's almost like the players are starting to, I guess, drive that culture around it. And yeah, like for me, that has to be the first point. And I was talking to one of our coaches the other day that around the care part, like care has several faces. So it's not just, you know, it's like being a parent, right? Your love is unconditional, but the care part is, you know, sometimes that's a really stern conversation around not meeting some expectations around behavior. You know, and I think if you don't do that, you're not demonstrating care. Like if you walk past that and go, oh, I don't really want to have that conversation because I've told everybody that I really love and care for them and that doesn't feel right to me, well, you're actually just not caring. And so I think we need to be open that ultimately, you know, care is something that, you know, is both the arm around approach as well as sometimes the finger in the chest to be like, mate, come on. And probably don't see it too dissimilar to parenting, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I understand you exactly. I'm not a parent, but I have two younger brothers. And I know exactly. It's, it's often an arm around, but also, you know, there's let them know where they can be better, where they need to be better as well. Because, yeah, 100%, because you care about them. You don't want them making these stupid mistakes over and over again or being less than they can be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then chat to me about how you got into professional rugby. Was it through that? Because you started out in club and you said you didn't play. You said you weren't the best player. So what, you just got into your coach club rugby and then opportunities came with underage teams?
Yeah, so I'm really proud of my journey. So it's been hard. Like I've always, I started coaching in 2010. I had no aspirations to be a coach. So I finished playing in 2009. New coach of our club in 2010 basically asked me and said, hey, would you come along and help me out with the forwards? So I was like, oh yeah, I can do that. That's a good way to stay involved in the club. And really passionate club man. Never played at any higher level other than club rugby. Probably never had the skill, talent, or work ethic to do any better than that. I was quite happy with kind of where I was at. And coached club rugby for 6 years. I think probably for the first 3 years of that, thought I knew everything, coach systems. Couldn't understand why people weren't knocking on my door to get them to come and coach their professional team. Had a couple of big failure moments where I learned lots about myself and my coaching, and continued to kind of have more of those moments over the next couple of years. Well, continue to every day probably, but yeah, some real big ones over that period. And yeah, I was really fortunate that you know, Clayton wanted to demonstrate a pathway for coaches within our region, and he was passionate about that. So he gave myself and Marty Burke an opportunity to coach at EPC level in 2019. We'd coached the under-19s together for a couple of years and managed to win a national title in 2018, which was pretty awesome. Beat Canterbury, which was even better. And you know, Maddie's now gone on to do some pretty awesome things, similar sort of path to me. He's now managed to crack at the Super Rugby with the Chiefs, and you know, before that, coach Canterbury, and also coach in the MLR for a couple of years with New York. So really awesome to see him do good things. And I think, you know, that's why I'm really passionate about bringing people through in Manawatu as well. Like I said to the union, I'm not from Manawatu, and I want myself to be the last non-Manawatu person that's the head coach of this team. And in order to achieve that, we have to put some really good things in place around developing coaches and giving local people an opportunity. So, and we're doing those things now, which is you know, really cool. So, yeah, certainly fortunate. Like, it was really all around an opportunity from Clayton, and had he not given me one, I'd probably still be coaching club rugby or school rugby or some sort of representative stuff. Like, I love it. Yeah, I love the professional end of the game as well, but I think our community stuff is still, it still motivates me to go and watch club rugby and go and watch some school rugby, and I, you know, see coaches out there doing their thing, and I take my hat off to them. Like, it's a pretty lonely vocation a lot of the time, eh? And I think about coaching club rugby, probably a, you know, voluntary position, probably doing about 20 hours a week. Don't regret it one little bit. It was awesome.
Yeah, class. Yeah, 100% it is. Yeah, it's enjoyable. And then a random one, I saw you were appointed head coach of China Lions, or is it a team. what was that about, or how did that come about?
Yeah, so China Lions was basically a partnership between Bay of Plenty Rugby and the China Rugby Football Association. And we played in the Global Rapid Rugby Competition in 2020, which was the COVID year. And so how that came about was Western Force got kicked out of Super Rugby. Twiggy Forrest is obviously the owner. They had no competition to play, and so he went and created one. And in 2019, they had a few exhibition games. And then 2020, I think there was 8 teams or something like that entered into this competition. Team from Malaysia, which is a South African team, similar sort of thing, partnership between Malaysian rugby and a South African Currie Cup team. Team in Hong Kong, which was basically the Hong Kong national team. A team in Fiji, Samoa, Western Force, and us. I think that was it. And so, yeah, this was really exciting. We were scheduled to play 3 games in New Zealand as home games, 3 games in Shanghai. We had a whole bunch of New Zealand players. We were due to have 4 Chinese players arrive into the team. Then COVID hit, and so we played a couple of preseason games here. We then went to Fiji to play our first round game, which was against the Fijian Lutui, which is the same concept as the Drua. I think we got there on a Wednesday. News broke on Wednesday night that the NBA had been shut down due to COVID. We're going, oh, okay, this is going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I think Thursday or Friday, the NRL had been shut down. Our competition was still running. We played our game on the Saturday. We flew back to Auckland on the Sunday, and we were supposed to fly out on Sunday night to Malaysia to play that team. I think on Saturday night after the game, those travel arrangements had been cancelled. We were then supposed to fly to Perth, and the rest of the tournament be played there. So that was all. Obviously, have to go through a period of player consultation because players are really concerned around being caught outside of New Zealand. Borders were starting to be closed. I think it was the following Friday, New Zealand went into lockdown. So it'll be a great Spates bottle cap question one day. Who won the, you know, who were the China Lions, or who won this game between the China Lions and the Fijian Lutui? Like, it was, yeah, like everything, I guess, happens for a reason. And I was really excited about that opportunity. We played one game, and then it all got kind of shut down, and then my coaching career path went on a totally different direction. So yeah, fascinating. It was cool though. We spent 5 days in Suva and played a game, rain delay with thunder and lightning, and managed to win, which was awesome. And really, I can certainly see why the Drua so hard to beat over there. Like, it was like 7 p.m. at night, 28 degrees, 90% humidity. The ball was like a bar of soap. And, yeah, she's challenging. But, mate, that's going to be a story that nobody believes probably in 10 years' time. So at least we've got record of it now.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff. Yeah, that's annoying that was cancelled. That would have been very cool. Something I love about coaching is the travel within it and getting to see different places. And yeah, that would have been very cool going around Asia playing games.
Yeah, man, it would have been awesome. It is a shame, but hey, Western Force are back in Super Rugby, and I think that's a really good thing. And yeah, the China Lions are no more.
Yeah. And so at the moment, when you were mentioning some training there a while ago with a player in the kicking, is that an academy? Is that the academy? So is it the academy guys? Because wouldn't your guys be like playing Super Rugby, Club Rugby? You wouldn't have the team together now, would you?
Yeah, that's right. So we have an academy group, which is 17 players, and then an HP group, which is the top 20 or so players out of our club competition. We only have six contracted turbos in region at the moment. So we've got players playing in Japan, so a couple of guys there, seven guys playing in MLR, I think 12 guys playing Super Rugby, one guy in Aussie. So there's definitely a trend that players want to play year-round, and you know, once players become established at NPC level, they're certainly looking at opportunities to play year-round and develop their game, which I think is really important. And I guess the downside of that is, you know, it takes those players out of club rugby, which I understand. So we've had a big push around attracting players into the region who want to play for the Turbos. We've got six or seven contracts still available for our NPC team. We've had about 15 or 20 players move into the region that want to give that a crack. They're all in region playing club rugby, you know, which is great. And I think we need to be, like, how I've sold this to our clubs is we're going to grow our academy program. So that's more than likely going to be 15 players in our year one group for 2025. We're going to continue to have contract positions open with the Turbos, so players come into the region wanting to give that a crack. So we might end up with, you know, 25 to 30 players coming into the region every year, or being retained into the region in terms of our school leavers, but high quality players that are motivated to have an opportunity. And that gives us a training group, which is really important, because, you know, we need our players playing and training together. It's that Pedro Panthers model around, and we've got a really good 9 and 10 in our academy group this year, Jai Tamati and Liam O'Connor. And, you know, they are, you know, exceptional, good young players. But we need them training and playing together. So they're playing for the same club team. They're in the Hurricanes in the 20s. They've played two games for our academy in February. They're training now. We put them together in our trainings, and we want to build their connection. So the unfortunate reality is we don't have a model like the NRL where these players get to play together from, you know, under 16s upwards. And get that meaningful development. So we need to find some creative ways to do that, which is what we're chasing at the moment.
Yeah, geez, that's a great way to be able to attract players into your region, having contracts available.
Yeah, and it's a point of difference for us, you know. So if you look at Canterbury, we played them and they pumped us by 60-odd points. They had one player out of their 23 who wasn't a current Super Rugby player, which was Blair Murray, who I coached in Chiefs under-18s in 2018 or 19. He was the best player in the country at that time, I reckon. And it's taken them 5 years or whatever to 4 years to make the Canterbury NPC team. They had six former All Blacks on the field. And so what they can't do is offer players a real pathway to get into the NPC team quickly. And we can, because we have an immature roster in terms of, you know, the number of caps that players have played. You know, we've got a roster that's probably going to move or shift quite a lot over the next couple of years. So, you know, we're absolutely, you know, open and honest around the fact that, you know, our roster's not where we'd like it to be, but that's cool. We've got an opportunity to build that over the next couple of years. And if you want an opportunity, come to Manawatu, and there's some positions there where there's spots open for this year. There'll be some different positions open for next year when guys move on and go on to do other things and stuff. So, yeah, I think we've got to look at that as a positive. because not everybody can do that. You know, I think Hawke's Bay have pretty much got their roster sorted. Taranaki wouldn't be that far off. They've got high levels of retention from last season. So, you know, those better teams are way more, I guess, stable. You know, they're loaded with 15 to 20 Super Rugby players, so that doesn't really change for them year on year. So the only way we're going to get there is to grow some of our own.
Yeah, and then you get everyone back, what, a couple of weeks before the tournament, for the first game?
Yeah. So we assemble on the 15th of July. That'll be assembly date for everybody. We won't have some of our MLR players back by then. We'll have everybody else, with the exception of guys that make the All Blacks or make the New Zealand 20s. They won't be back by then. So we're looking at just training in the evenings in the first week so we can, you know, have a wider squad training. Second week, we're playing a preseason game against Tasman. And we should have everybody back on deck by then. Following week of preseason against Wellington, and then we're into it. First up, Tasman at home. So that'll be cool. We'll play them in preseason and then play them a couple of weeks later. So, it's challenging. Like, you only get a little bit of, you know, small amount of time together. But what we need is, if we've got six contracted players at the moment in region and another five or six that end up getting contracts, you know, that's a decent cohort to have a whole bunch of learning, entrenched in them over the next 4 months. They can then lead some of the stuff once we get into our pre-season window. And again, that'll be a point of difference for us. Like, I was talking to the Hawke's Bay CEO at an academy game. He said they only have one contracted player currently in region, and most of their roster's full. So, it's pretty challenging for what they're running at the moment in terms of academy and HP to be hugely advantageous when they hit the season. So I think we can have an objective to be the best prepared team going into the preseason window. I think that's realistic, given that we've got a group of players in region that are either exceptional academy players who might not play this year, but they probably will next year. Some guys that are going to get contracted, plus some others that are already on contract. So glass half full when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah, class. Definitely some good opportunities there. Hey, Mike, thanks a mil for jumping on chatting. Been unreal. Really appreciate it.
Mate, yeah, thank you very much for your time. Like I said, my partner asked me what I was going to talk about, and I said I'd probably just talk shit for an hour. So I'm looking up at your timer on your Flash podcast video thing, and it's saying an hour four. So, mate, I've even given you 4 minutes of extra shit.
Cheers.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers for listening in today. If you want to be an absolute legend, please send the pod on some friends now. You can leave a rating and a review as well on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, and make sure you're subscribed so that you don't miss an episode. Unleash Your Potential is now live. This is a course I created specifically for players who want to be professionals. It's over 6.5 hours of content and goes through everything you need to know. You can get this now through the link in the podcast description. If you want to get in touch with me about anything, please do. My Instagram is @offfieldrugby or @BrianMoylett, and my LinkedIn is Brian Moylett, and you can DM me on any of those. If you're an athlete or a leader and want to work with me one-on-one to help you get where you want to go and achieve what you know deep down you can, go to my website now, offfieldrugby.com, and book a free 30-minute Zoom call. I work with sports teams over Zoom and in person, helping players access flow state, play in the zone, build resilience, increase confidence, overcome fear of failure, and on all areas of the mental game. I also work with coaches and leaders on theming for the season and building a winning culture and environment. If this sounds like something your team would benefit from, get in touch through LinkedIn, Brian Moylett, or the website offfieldrugby.com, or also my email is offfieldrugby@gmail.com, any of those. And finally, I do high performance workshops for businesses, once again, in person and on Zoom. And in these workshops, well-being is covered as well. In them, I'll show you tools to mitigate stress and pressure, teach you how to increase your focus and your attention span,
give you simple strategies you can use immediately to increase productivity while improving your well-being. So essentially, you'll be feeling better, you'll get better quality work done, and you'll have more time. If you're a business leader and feel your team would benefit from this, you can get in contact through all the ways I've mentioned. My email's offfieldrugby@gmail.com, my LinkedIn, Brian Moylett. Thanks again to you for listening today. Really appreciate it. Be good to yourself and have a brilliant rest of your day. Cheers.